Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. Journalism is changing. All reporters are both living in the pandemic and reporting on it. Our country is facing a reckoning on the history of systemic racism that affects all of us. Locally, student reporters are calling on news outlets to acknowledge the racism inherent in how the concept of objectivity plays out in our newsrooms. Today, we are facing this head-on at KUNM, discussing decision-making in the news and how we can all do better. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about how journalists report on stories? How can we be more transparent? Give us your ideas. Call us at 277-5866 or tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. I want to welcome my first guest, Lissa Knudsen, into the conversation. Lissa is a PhD student at the UNM School of Communication and Journalism and the news editor for the Daily Lobo. Good morning, Lissa.
Good morning.
So the Daily Lobo recently published an editorial titled Journalism's Problematic Love Affair with Objectivity. Can you give me a nutshell version of what this editorial is about?
Sure. We, after a lot of deliberation in the newsroom, as editors came together and we drafted this piece, first starting with our own sort of reckoning with our history at the Daily Lobo with printing and engaging in racist behavior, right? So first we laid out that in 2011, we ran a cartoon that depicted President Obama as a monkey. Mm-hmm. We acknowledged that in 1982, we ran an editorial that stated that minority students were less intellectually capable than white students. Mm-hmm. And we recognized even more systemic than that, that even, you know, right now in our current newsroom, we still are making decisions about which stories to cover, what parts of the story to highlight, what parts of the story to downplay, who we interview is most likely to be somebody that we recognize or feel comfortable with. And because right now we have a predominantly white editorial board, which, you know, happens more often than not, We wanted to recognize that reality. Mm-hmm. From there, though, we then transitioned into beyond, our actual acts of our own sort of systemic racism is this notion of objectivity that we're taught in our journalism classes and our own struggle with that, where we recognize that, in fact, the notion of objectivity was preventing us from telling an accurate and fair story because of the power balances that existed, you know, in the world that we're in. And specifically, we were talking about state-sanctioned violence and racism.
Can you give me some examples of how an attempt to stay, quote, objective or neutral skewed a story from the truth or inhibited your reporting?
You know, everything from the phrase officer-involved shooting, which, you know, when a police officer, kills somebody else or murders somebody, to call it officer-involved seems very, you know, like almost like whitewashing, like we're not recognizing what's actually happening. Something more local than that, but on the same vein, was, you know, about a week before we ran this editorial, the Albuquerque Journal had a headline that said, "Man tied to shooting released," when they were referring to the shooter at the Oñate protest. Mm-hmm. And tied to shooting is just such vague language that's not communicating to the reader, this is the person who had the gun in their hand, who pulled the trigger, who had a bullet that went into somebody else's body, right? Tied, what does that even mean? So right. Those are just a couple examples.
And I do want to state that we did reach out to the Albuquerque Journal to talk with us about some of these issues today, but they did decline to join us. So I want to go back a little bit just to Man Tied to Shooting Released. Could you get a little bit more into about how that might be read as objective when in fact it is not?
You know, I mean, I think that there is something that's taught in journalism classes, that we sometimes call both sidesism, mm-hmm. Or false balance, where, you know, the journalist is taught to get, a quote from both sides of the story. And in that particular story, it might be the person who was shot and then the person who, you know, did the shooting, or even the press releases coming from the police department. And what's not being recognized there is that to equally sort of cover those two things doesn't acknowledge that some people have entire PIO departments. Some people have relationships with reporters that they interact with on a regular basis, and they're pushing information to them, and they're professional spin, you know, masters, and they know how to use language, and they know what they've done testing and polling, right? Versus the average person on the street, or possibly somebody who's historically been depressed or oppressed from a community that, you know, doesn't have the same access to privilege and power, they're not going to have the same sort of packaged, you know, message.
Right.
And so treating those as equal, I think, is problematic. So, you know, specifically with the man tied to shooting, I think that there was an interest there to not commit libel or slander and, you know, until there was an actual conviction, to not actually state that that person had, you know, committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't recognize that the court systems are also part of the systemic problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back to the Rodney King, you know, beating back in the early 90s, right? Many of the community members felt that the media coverage played a role in that Simi Valley jury that was almost all white acquitting those police officers, even though everyone around the world had seen the tape in which obvious excessive force was used. And I think that's playing a role too, right? The access to video recordings, it changes the way that we should be approaching some of these stories, I believe.
So what kind of reaction are you getting from your readers in regards to this editorial?
You know, readers have been really supportive. I think that student readers, especially who've been participating actively in the protests, are really proud and have been sharing our story, saying that maybe the Daily Lobo has the most, you know, accurate, refreshing perspective of any of the publications in the state. So that's been really positive, and we're really proud to, you know, be able to connect with our readers that way. We have had some pushback, though, from people within the journalism community.
So tell me, what are they saying about what you wrote?
I mean, it's mixed, right? Some journalists are really excited about this. They've been hungry for it, right? The Columbia, Journalism Review back in 2003 wrote a piece about objectivity and how problematic it was. And the Society for Professional Journalists back in the 90s actually removed objectivity from their ethics code. So this is not a new conversation within journalism. But interestingly, mostly female women identifying journalists have contacted me, not because they disagree so much with what we're saying, but they're afraid for us, right? They want to protect us, and they've been telling us we should be careful. We may never work in this town or in this state because there's such an entrenched sort of perspective within the journalistic community. But all of us discussed amongst ourselves, and we decided we needed to stand for what we believed in anyway. You know, and I don't know if it's millennials and Zoomers just don't have the same approach to careers that, you know, those that came before do, but I think that it's more important to them to call out what they see as problematic than to worry about their future careers.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like many people might be misunderstanding what you mean when you say the problematic relationship with, or the problematic love affair with objectivity?
Think that there's a possibility that that's the case. I mean, I appreciate you asking you know, me to be on the show to represent it. And, you know, we in hindsight wish that we had done maybe multiple pieces. It could have been a 5,000 word piece. I don't know if anyone reads that much anymore. but I do think that, you know, at face value, some might be assuming that we're advocating against fairness or accuracy. And I would say that it's the exact opposite. I think we absolutely want to tell the true story, whatever the truth is, and specifically we want to make sure those that have historically not had power are heard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about just, you know, taking all of our baggage into a story and writing it from a slanted or biased perspective. It's really about making sure that those who haven't been heard are, you know, given the space for their own voices to be heard. It's not our job to, you know, give them voice. I think that it's really about making sure that all voices are in fact recognized.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, now I'd like to introduce Joy Mayer, the director of Trusting News, an organization that helps news outlets take an active role in gaining trust with the public. Good morning, Joy. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, your organization is all about helping news outlets gain trust. Why is the public so mistrustful of journalism?
Well, trust in journalism, like in many institutions, has been declining for decades. This is not a brand new problem. Trust in media actually peaked a few years after Watergate in the late 70s and has been declining ever since. You know, it started with the rise of sort of talk radio in the 80s, deregulation of news, cable news. You know, the easier it got for people to find a version of news that they agreed with, the harder it is for us as a society to sort of agree on a shared set of facts. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people prefer to get news that confirms their outlook on the world. Mm-hmm. And that causes them to distrust information that doesn't confirm that outlook.
I see. So Lissa Knudsen, the news editor for the Daily Lobo, is on the line with us. And we were just talking about the way a news organization's attempts to be, quote, objective can actually cause different communities to trust us less. Have you found that to be the case in the work that you do?
Definitely. I think that there are, for people who don't trust the news, a lot of times that rests in a fundamental awareness that their lives are not reflected in the news. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people feel like what they see in journalism doesn't reflect what's happening in their daily life, and they don't see that it is created by people like them for people like them, and especially communities of color, and increasingly also conservative news consumers just feel like it's coming from a place and a perspective that doesn't represent their reality.
Now, you talk a bit about how the concept of objectivity is not something that's been with news since the beginning. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that term and how it's brought us to the present day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the concept of objectivity, came to journalism early in the last century, and it was actually about bringing scientific principles to journalism. It was about using objective, observable, repeatable methods of verification in reporting. Mm-hmm. It was never about the idea of sort of neutrality or being disinterested or separate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it is a fairly new concept in the history of news. And so it's not about being disinterested, you say, but rather scientific. How does being scientific relate to the news today? Is that a possibility?
I think that it's a constant struggle. It's something we strive for is really the way I look at it, mm-hmm. rather than something we achieve. It's something that organizations overall have as a goal to, not mindlessly give both sides equal treatment to something or to use balance I think striving for balance and fairness is a good idea, but I think that doesn't mean equal airtime for all views. And I think, not checking our humanity at the door, but bringing it with us into our work and using the sort of checks and balances that are inherent in how journalism operates is a really good idea. I think one challenge we really have is that, as Lissa was saying, newsrooms are not nearly diverse enough. Mm-hmm. And so the checks and balances in newsrooms where we say to each other, are you sure you're getting this right? Did you think to ask this question? Is that really the fairest word to use? I think that we sort of take that for granted that we do that with each other in newsrooms. But in newsrooms, there's a lack of diversity of opinion. There's a lack of diversity of culture, mm-hmm. race, economic class, and all of those things make it harder for newsrooms to accurately reflect the diversity of the communities they cover.
Now, we're definitely going to be talking more about that diversity question, but I did want to go to something you said just now about reporters having humanity. Can you tell me why it's important that reporters not deny their humanity, but rather embrace it or promote it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that who we are as people and our own experiences inform how we do journalism. You know, if you send different reporters to cover a story, they're going to pick up on different cues. They're going to have different questions they know to ask based on their own experiences and knowledge. So if I think personally about where I've lived, what my parents do for a living, my faith, how my family and society sort of operates, my economic class, all of those things make me, all of those things inform what I will choose to focus on in a story, what I choose to highlight, who I choose to interview. What we learn to do as reporters is be aware of blind spots that might also cause and, acknowledge that other people's truth could be different from our own. So what we really need to do is acknowledge how our own experiences inform our reporting so that we can be aware of blind spots and hold ourselves and our colleagues accountable.
Okay, I'm Ty Bannerman, and you are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. This morning, we are talking about the news itself and how the way that objectivity is practiced sometimes gets in the way of reporting a full story. And we are taking your calls, 277-5866, and you can send us an email with your comments at letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to take a quick break.
Glassrite, New Mexico's own. Since 1984, manufacturing and installing vinyl replacement windows. Built in New Mexico for our unique climate. Plus wood-clad windows by Gelled Wen. On Gibson or at glassrite.com. Glassrite supports KUNM. Support comes from Il Vicino Restaurants in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. Open for a dine-in service Monday through Thursday, 11 to 8 p.m. and Friday through Sunday, 11 to 9 p.m. Accepting call-in and online orders as well as deliveries through DoorDash. IlVicino.com.
The Minnesota Orchestra played a concert in the middle of March with no audience in the house, but live on stage and live on the radio. We've got the story and highlights from that concert for an eerie, empty hall on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman, and we have a call from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen. What is your comment or question today?
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to throw my two cents in here. I pretty much trust the news as a whole, coming from the radio and the NPR and stuff like that. But the ones that I actually don't pay attention to are the news feeds coming from Facebook, because there's a lot of fake news out there. But
are there certain outlets that you look to when you're browsing through Facebook that you do trust more than others, or do you find that anything that's kind of on Facebook is immediately suspect?
No, I don't read those.
Okay,
I just kind of dismiss it. Because I just go and just look at the stuff that my friends and family are doing rather than the news outlets,
okay.
The news feeds.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Ellen. And actually, Lisa, I'd like to go back to you for this topic. You mentioned that maybe millennials and Zoomers have a different approach to how they report the news. I'd imagine that they also have a different approach in how they interact with social media. Are you finding that to be the case in your role at the Daily Lobo?
Absolutely. Part of it is out of like a values decision, but part of it's out of the fact that, you know, our reporters are students and they get paid $16 a story. So they're not doing it for the big bucks. And given that, and given our own appreciation of, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, we have made a newsroom decision to allow our reporters to be honest about their opinions in their social media. That doesn't mean that, you know, we encourage them to just, you know, engage with all the trolls and get into, you know, Twitter fights. But it really allows them, I think, the opportunity from their perspective and what they've seen by being on the ground, say, at a protest and having tear gas cans thrown at them, to be able to, you know, honestly acknowledge that they have an opinion on an issue. And to your other panelists' point, I think that actually enhances truth. And I think it means that people trust their reporting more because they're not pretending to be some sort of, you know, I don't know, fake person that doesn't have an opinion about things.
Mm-hmm. And Joy, I'd imagine that newsrooms across the country are sort of evaluating and reevaluating the relationship to social media. How do you find that social media plays a role in the public's trust for different news outlets?
I think that how, where sort of individual news outlets stand and where they, how comfortable they feel with individual staff members asserting where they stand is a choice that's going to vary based on the goals of each publication and the relationship they have with their audience. I do think in general that standing against racism is something more news organizations should feel comfortable just being clear about. And I think that, you know, expecting I think there's a difference between advocating for solutions and pointing out problems. And I just think in general that we're sort of overdue as an industry for a reckoning in how we expect journalists to check their humanity at the door and how we expect a certain sort of neutrality or maybe even whiteness to be the default and what that does to harm relationships with communities of color.
Can you talk a little bit more about that idea of whiteness being the expected norm?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that's come up in the industry lately is, you know, whether journalists of color are the right people to be covering protests. And it's a confusing conversation to me because, you know, usually having expertise in a community or an issue makes you more qualified to cover it. But, you know, some newsrooms have been questioning whether, you know, non-white reporters can keep themselves sort of separate enough or you know, objective enough, to use that complicated word, to accurately cover something. And I just think it's so crucial that we see experiences as a strength and that we, you know, identify where we need to work to hold each other accountable and make sure that we are fairly covering multiple aspects of a story. But I think standing against racism and sending people with relevant experience to cover something like, you know, anti-racism protests is appropriate.
So is the idea that a white reporter would somehow be more objective in covering a Black Lives Matter protest?
Sad to say, I think that is too often an accepted idea, yes.
And is that something that also extends to gender when covering things like abortion?
Oh, interesting question. I'm sure there are people who would say that, yes, that somehow the absence of being affected by an issue directly would instead of being recognized as a perspective in and of itself, would feel to some people like the absence of a perspective.
Okay. So also joining me this morning are Hannah Colton and Marisa DeMarco, both of whom work with me here at KUNM. Hannah is the news director here and therefore my boss. And Marisa is a longtime reporter. Good morning, Marisa and Hannah.
Good morning.
Good morning. So actually, I want to go to Marisa quickly here to react to this idea that maybe reporters of color would somehow be biased in covering certain stories that affect reporters of color. What's your thought on that?
It's so interesting to have this example of Black reporters not being allowed to cover Black Lives Matter protests because, you know, these issues of racism, they don't only involve Black people. They're often perpetuated by white people, right? So when it comes to police killings, you're seeing often white police officers killing Black people. So the idea that it should only be a white reporter who engages in this conversation because somehow they're not, you know, their race doesn't make them part of the conversation, it just completely misses the fact that the Black Lives Matter movement exists because of violence and abuses perpetuated by white people, right? So it's just the strangest kind of acrobatics.
So it seems like it betrays a sort of an assumption that that our society makes about who is affected by racism when, in fact, it's a two-way street, right?
Well, but it's also, what I'm saying is that it's white people who are perpetuating, who are enacting the racism, right? Mm-hmm. So are white reporters then, you know, not allowed to cover those, you know, Black Lives Matter because they're part of the race that perpetuates the violence, right? Like, you just, once you start down that path, you end up kind of betraying your own, the way that the white perspective, which we know that newsrooms are still largely white, the white perspective is somehow considered to be omnipotent or objective or something, right?
Okay, I have a call from Paul in Albuquerque. Good morning, Paul. What is your comment or question today?
Hey, good morning. I just want to say I worked in television news for about 20 years, and I came to it through ethnographic filmmaking training. And You know, one of the things we learned in school was the fact that prejudice wasn't a bad word. It's just where you come from. And in ethnographic filmmaking, you kind of had to relearn your prejudices or discover them mm-hmm. by studying other races, other tribes, and who they were and where they came from and how they communicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today news has changed. You know, there's a little-known fact, whether you know it or not. You know, news used to be this this kind of pious existence where you did tell both sides of the story, and that mm-hmm. was allowed to happen. But in 1984, in North Carolina, NBC owned and operated station made the first profit of a television news cast in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And from that day on, television news in the commercial market became a money-making operation instead of the system that we traditionally knew. And
mm-hmm.
and then the stories started being directed. And, you know, I feel today, and I've discussed this with other people, that even NPR on a national level seems to be mimicking more and more
mm-hmm.
of the style that national news tells their stories, the national commercial stations. And I'm wondering if it isn't because, you know, NPR during, I think it was the Bush years, you know, you really had to start raising money from listeners to get that in there. And so really you're trying to tell a story that your audience is going to listen to, and you got to understand your audience in order, you know, to remain viable.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand what I mean.
Okay, that's an interesting point, Paul. And I'd like to actually go to Hannah Colton, who's the news director here at KUNM. Hannah, can you talk a little bit about the role that seeking funding plays in how, like, say, our news department works?
Sure, Kai. I mean, we're in a really lucky position, right, as a public media organization where we're not beholden to advertisers in the same way that TV news and, you know, big newspapers are. So that's, you know, I would say that really plays a role in how we can be truly independent and can make these, like, sort of choices that are considered risky editorially. I mean, we have a lot of listener support, obviously, and we have underwriters.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of like public media speak for advertisers, but it's a different framework. But the independence of public media is like a foundational principle, right? So I mm-hmm. think everyone who contributes to public media kind of understands that they're supporting like this public institution that's not going to be swayed by any particular underwriters or mm-hmm. listeners' interests. And so it's kind of like the funding sources are more scattered in that way.
Okay. So I want to go back to this concept of objectivity that we've been discussing throughout the show. The Lobo takes it to task for furthering white supremacy. Trusting News frames as a sort of an invented concept that's actually impossible to attain in the way that we understand it now. How do you view this idea of objectivity, Hannah? And what sorts of problems does it present in certain kinds of reporting?
It's really complicated. I think obviously like there are objective facts, right? Like there are facts that, you know, climate change is real fact, objective fact. Racism is harmful, objective mm-hmm. fact. Like I certainly would never argue that there like is no such thing as an objective fact, but I think framing like the pursuit of journalism as a pursuit of objectivity or neutrality or something is kind of just like the wrong focus. Because, as a journalist and now as someone who's like assigning stories and editing stories, it's like we make a million subjective decisions throughout that whole process. And, you know, as the other guests have talked about, that's always going to be informed by who we are. You know, I'm white, I'm from the Midwest, I'm from, you know, a middle class, relatively privileged background. Like all of those things are going to inform the decisions that I make, unless and to the extent that I'm like challenging my own biases, right? So it's more about like being real with yourself about your biases, being transparent with the audience, like here's how this issue might affect me. You know, we report in the community that we live in. So if we know our sources, if we have prior relationships to sources, like we disclose that. We try to be transparent about why we're covering the things we're covering, why we make certain decisions that we make. But yeah, there's just so many subjective decisions that go into each reporter's, you know, decisions about who to talk to, how to frame a story, what kind of context to include, what kind of history to include. And so I do see objectivity sort of like capital O objectivity as like something that's never been attainable and it's not really, shouldn't be necessarily the focus as much as transparency and accuracy and fairness.
Now, Marisa, you've been working in a variety of newsrooms for a while now. Can you talk to me a little bit about your experiences, maybe a time when the typical assumptions of old school reporting and objectivity maybe hindered your work on a story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just, real quick though, I just want to jump a little bit off of what Hannah was saying. And I just want to say that because we know that newsrooms are largely white, I think you found a stat that says that there's still 75% white across the country and that that outpaces, you know, even other industries, right?
Right.
That the idea of objectivity completely evades the fact that what is actually practiced as objectivity is white perspective, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is a way that right now objectivity is heavily tied to white perspective and white bias.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, because the attempt is objectivity, you know, it makes people even more resistant to the idea that they might have a bias, right? Because what your whole profession is like hinged on you being objective. So how could you have a racial bias that you're carrying around as a white person, right? Like, yeah. Okay. So leaping off of that though, I've worked in many different newsrooms and this has come up throughout my career as a reporter, all the way from what kinds of stories, I pitch that get accepted, to recently, I was, I think maybe a year or two ago, I was reporting on transgender asylum seekers who are leaving detainment. And I met with them, I think, like an hour after they had gotten out of detention. And I aired that story for KUNM, and I pitched it to NPR. And, you know, through the process of editing, the voices of the transgender asylum seekers were slowly being pulled out of the story and replaced with white experts, you know, all the way up until the story was supposed to air, ended up calling the editor and saying, I'm not comfortable with this story airing anymore, right? And part of that is because I don't want to ever present people as only their suffering or only as victims and part of what was being removed from the story was talking to these folks about their strategies for resilience, their own political perspectives, their understandings of the systems that they had been inside of. That was being eroded and replaced with this kind of white expert voice or this generic statement that had aired a million times on NPR from ICE. Because ICE was just sending out one paragraph,
right.
via email. And I was like, why do we have to run that statement again? It's been on the air a ton, right? So that was one example that stood out really clearly to me, because part of it is, I was trying to say to the editor, like, isn't what makes this story special mm-hmm. that I'm here, that I met these folks as they're leaving ICE detention, that I hung out with them and talked to them, right? Like, isn't that what's special about this story, as opposed to me reaching out to national white experts on immigration around the country? Like, NPR can do that work. What's interesting about having a reporter on the ground is that, you know, that I meet people face to face in these moments, you know?
Well, we are going to have to go to break. Thank you, Marisa, for sharing that. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We'll be back in a moment.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, covering news, arts, and entertainment for Albuquerque since 1992. The friends at Weekly Alibi invite the community to help support local independent journalism when it's needed the most. Info at alibi.com/friends.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, what can a congressional election in the Bronx tell us about the direction of the Democratic Party? It turns out, a lot.
There have been few candidates in the race who have spent more time attempting to assassinate my character as an LGBTQ candidate than that of Ruben Diaz Sr., who is a vicious homophobe.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
Native waiters, store clerks, hairdressers, and those who do face-to-face customer service are on the front lines of keeping some businesses afloat. They also face an added risk during the coronavirus pandemic. We'll hear from Native service workers on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are taking a look this morning at the assumptions of the news industry itself and how it can sometimes fall into the trap of systemic racism. Join the conversation by calling 277-5866. And Marisa, right before the break, you mentioned a statistic that I had found that came from a 2018 article by the Pew Research Center that found that 77% of newsroom employees across the country, those who work as reporters, editors, photographers, anybody who works in a news-related capacity, are non-Hispanic whites. More, in fact, than the average for all other U.S. workplaces. And I want to go to Joy Mayer, who's with us from the Trusting News Organization. I wanted to ask you, how does that fact hurt our industry's ability to accurately report stories?
It's a huge factor. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised that number's not even higher, the percentage of white employees. I know some newsrooms do a lot better than others at that. But when you think about all of the subjective decisions involved in newsmaking, what stories to cover, how intensely to cover them, what sources to look at, what information to highlight, what to downplay, what background and context to add. Those things, as I was saying earlier, you know, really rest on our own experiences and perspectives. And there are a lot of things that I, going into a story cold, just don't even know to ask. And there's a constant education process involved in being a journalist that are just educating ourselves about an issue enough to be able to cover it credibly. Mm-hmm. And it's like every time we cover an issue that involves race or predominantly affects communities of color, it's like we're starting from scratch as white journalists to try to understand that fully enough to credibly report on it. And often we just don't get there.
Okay. And Lissa, you mentioned, of course, that your newsroom, like many and apparently most newsrooms across the country, is predominantly white. What steps are you taking to make sure that you can accurately report on issues that are, you know, as Joy just described, maybe outside of your reporter's experience and knowledge areas?
You know, we struggle with this a lot, and we've done a few things intentionally to try to address this. One is we intentionally invite guest columnists who represent the communities that they want to talk about. We recently ran a guest column from an English PhD student who is Navajo about her experience as a Native American student during COVID-19. And of course, her story was so much more accurate and rich about her having to take care of her grandparents and drive back and bring supplies and mm-hmm. in ways that no one in our newsroom could have possibly even thought to ask about. Other things that we have done is, you know, that story I mentioned earlier in which, you know, we wrote an editorial that was overtly racist. You know, people before me made the decision to post that story above our drinking fountain, which is an intentional placement. And mm-hmm. So anyone in our newsroom, whoever goes to get a drink of water, looks up and sees our history and recognizes that we need to be humble. We need to recognize our own privilege and we need to check ourselves as often as possible. You know, other things that we're doing is, you know, again, just trying to reach out and put the intention behind trying to diversify, as well as recognizing that, you know, it takes a critical mass. Having one or two people of color in a newsroom does not create a safe space for people to actually have influence over decisions. Mm-hmm. We really need to be a majority person of color newsroom before we expect to see our coverage be able to shift.
Okay. And Hannah, I'd like to put the same question to you. As you mentioned, you are white. You're the news director here. I have to mention, of course, that I am also white. How is KUNM making sure that we can accurately cover issues that relate to communities of color?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is like the very slow hiring process of the university, right? So we have a position that's going to be coming open, like a regional reporter position, and I'll definitely be recruiting for journalists of color and strongly encouraging Black and Brown and Native American reporters to apply to that position. There's also an idea that I learned from a facilitator in an anti-racism workshop of being accountable to community, right? And like mm-hmm. knowing always like that the only way that you're going to learn from mistakes and get better and do coverage that is more responsive to the community is to like have people who are going to call you out, right? So mm-hmm. it's like I can never consider myself separate from the community that I live in and that I cover. And it's like I really highly value, you know, people of color that I'm friends with, that I'm in community with, that I see at meetings, like, and always am trying to like keep an eye on those responses and change how we're doing things.
Okay, and Marisa, what do you think we could do better here at KUNM?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think we do push for there to be more folks in the newsroom who are not white people overall, and I think that has gone well over the years. I think additionally, though, it's, you know, you start to have questions about who is in positions of authority, right? Mm-hmm. And looking at leadership and making sure that people are being listened to, that they're being credited. Like, I've often felt like sometimes my concepts and my ideas around doing good reporting, especially around issues of race, then get, you know, parroted by colleagues or superiors, but there's never recognition necessarily that it came from me or came from someone else, right? So I think there's some of that, like just making sure that the balances of power and equity within the newsroom are adhered to well, and that people's perspectives are considered valuable and their contributions are valued. I do think that most newsrooms, you know, there's all this talk like, let's diversify the newsroom, let's make sure that the newsroom isn't all white, but there's often not policies put in place for the inevitable racism that mm-hmm. the people of color coming into your newsroom are going to experience, especially if they're the only person or like one of the first people. And so that often means that people burn out and quit. And mm-hmm. so that's why that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to just try to hire occasionally one person who is not white. You know, you have to be able to make sure that they feel like they have recourse if mm-hmm. they experience racism, or like their ideas are being taken seriously or not stolen from them, that, you know, that they have respect of their colleagues. So you have to do the follow-up work once you hire folks on. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, and this isn't necessarily a problem for right now, but you know, making sure that you don't ask the only reporters of color in your newsroom to write about their own particular race, mm-hmm. right? Like, you're not trying to silo people into only being able to write things from that perspective. You have to invite people to write about all the things that they're interested in and care about and are good at writing about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, we have a call from Roberta in Albuquerque, who is actually the director of Generation Justice, which is an organization that operates with KUNM. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning. I'm so glad you're having this discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So tell me, what would you like to add today?
Well, Generation Justice has been training journalists of color for about 15 years to cover media from the perspective of accuracy and fairness. And I just wanted to, like, you know, let our community know that we're still here and we're still doing this work. I love what Marissa just added to the conversation. It's not just about hiring journalists of color. It's about really looking at the institution of journalism in this country and how it has upheld white supremacy, and that it's been a tool of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that I also want to just encourage all of the journalists and others who are interested in journalism who are listening today to learn the history of journalism in this country. And there's a great resource that we use as part of our curriculum. It's a book entitled News for All the People. The authors are Juan Gonzalez, mm-hmm. who many know from Democracy Now!, and Joe Torres. And they cover the historic span of journalism in this country and how when Black journalists, when Latinx journalists and indigenous journalists throughout time have tried to hold the truth of communities, they have been shut down. They have been targeted mm-hmm. by mainstream journalism and companies so that their voices are not going to be heard with that accuracy and fairness. And so I think knowing the history of this country and knowing how white supremacy is in every part of the institutions that we live in mm-hmm. Is a real, real important factor in how we change systems to really be fair and accurate for all of us, not only in journalism, but in our lives.
That is absolutely a very interesting point, Roberta. And actually, I'd like to kind of springboard off of that. We have another email comment from Austin, who is kind of along the same track there. Austin says that they have worked full-time in journalism since 2015, and it's very rare for journalists to be able to talk freely about these kinds of issues and to make these kinds of fundamental changes. When newsroom management and journalism schools are upholding the status quo inside newsrooms, many journalists, some of them face retaliation if they bring these things up. So how can these ideals actually be implemented in newsrooms? How can the free speech of journalists be protected? And how can we make the kind of systemic changes necessary? Joy, I'd like to go to you for that question.
I think that, you know, it starts at the top in the management of news organizations, and it starts with a willingness to be uncomfortable and to have views challenged. And I think something that, you know, journalism, like other industries, rewards sort of confidence and certainty, and we're creatures of habit, and we do things over and over because they've proven to be successful, and we have metrics that gauge success based on certain things, and often ambiguity gets in the way of that and gets in the way of our efficiency. And so I think it really starts with management at the top being willing to ask them hard questions and making it clear that they want to be challenged. Mm-hmm. I think one challenge that journalism faces is that they like to see themselves as holding the powerful accountable, mm-hmm. but the perceptions among the people they aim to serve, the public, is very often that journalistic organizations are part of that power structure. Our understanding as journalists of the communities we cover too often are rooted in the opinions and perspectives of other powerful institutions in town. And so I think we need to grapple with that mm-hmm. more honestly within newsrooms and invite from within our ranks and from within the public we serve ideas that will challenge us to do better.
And I have a call from Walter in Albuquerque. Good morning, Walter. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'd like to offer a comment on this notion of objectivity. I've observed a phenomenon. Well, objectivity obviously is very important in journalism. It's also important in literature, science, just about everything we do. And sort of zooming out a little bit, it seems to me that we've historically pitted objectivity against some notion of relativity or subjectivity. And what I'm seeing in the last, say, 50 years, broad brushstroke, is a pendulum swing about these claims to objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is not so long ago, going back maybe to the 70s, it seems that conservative voices were the ones that were laying claim to objective truth.
Mm.
And they branded the left progressive voices as being relative, subjective, not grounded in fact, not grounded at all sometimes. And what I see in the last, say, 20, 30 years, is it seems to me that the right-wing strategy has been to cast doubt about truth and undermine truth by this notion of fake news and all that sort of thing that essentially has taken a page from the progressive playbook and turned it on its end in order to sow doubt about the very notion of truth
mm-hmm.
and to make people suspicious of anything that claims to be objective. So when you have someone like Trump claiming that there are good people on both sides, what you're doing is offering a voice to both sides, and both sides turn out, in my mind, not to be equally valid or reputable or believable. So I just like to say I think we need to restore some kind of trust in some form of truth, and that truth is something that journalism obviously has a lot to offer about, especially in these days and times. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for calling in. Hannah, I'd like to go to you with that comment. Certainly we're living in a time right now when we are getting distorted truth and conspiracy theories about COVID-19 being promoted by certainly most high-profile members of the Trump administration. What is your policy for, what is your kind of approach to reporting on that sort of thing? And we have to make it real quick.
I mean, like, one of our goals when it comes to the pandemic is, like, provide the urgent information that is going to help keep people safe and save lives, right? So precautions as well as we know them from health experts, what are resources that people need to get fed, to get to stay sheltered. I mean, we don't give a lot of airtime to ideas about COVID that are just like patently false, right? We're more concerned about people's safety.
Okay, and that is all the time that we have today. Thank you to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Lissa Knudsen of the Daily Lobo, Joy Mayer of Trusting News, Marisa DeMarco and Hannah Colton, both of KUNM. We did ask for an editor with the Albuquerque Journal to join us as well, but they did decline. The conversation does not have to end here. Share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM on Facebook, or email letstalk@kunm.org. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Yasmin Khan live tweeted the show today, and Megan Kamrick produced. Hannah Colton is our executive director. I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.